out. unaccustomed as I am to public speaking. Look, I'm going to be, you know, much more informal on this. What I just want to do is review some of the essential questions of the history that we discussed last night. And those of you who were here last night can correct me when I make a mistake or fill in something you think is important that I forgot. And then just briefly go through a few passages from Bloom's introduction to the Republic and what he says Plato says. And then actually look at what Plato says in the Republic in context, because it's relatively outrageous. And beyond that, I think I just want to open it up for questions and discussions in terms of other dialogues, other questions. Is Freddie here? I don't have a better answer to how Lynn talks about consubstantiality in the Timaeus and the Parmenides than I did last night, so don't ask again. But just to locate what I think are the most important historical points for understanding Plato, because it's like a Beethoven symphony. There are so many degrees of richness in terms of so many different manifolds in terms of what you're dealing with. They are most importantly spiritual exercises, which exercise the mind. In the method of seeing through your mind as opposed to seeing through your senses. But there are also very powerful political tragedies and dramas which are presenting for a relatively contemporary audience what led to the previous crises in the immediate generation before them in Greek society. I mean, you could think about Lynn writing a dialogue, about the Clinton administration, from the standpoint of where were the actual epistemological flaws in Clinton, and it would be an interesting exercise to think how you would actually do that, because as Lynn has said, Clinton was one of the most intelligent presidents we've had, certainly since John Kennedy. He obviously had a certain FDR impulse in terms of what he wanted to do, and then he did absolutely none of it. Not only that, when he was in a sense liberated from having to seek re-election and liberated from the impeachment scandal, you know, he certainly could have rose to the occasion and at least not endorsed Al Gore. You know, whether one would have presumed he had the guts to endorse Lynn, you know, is another question. But you could ask yourself, why didn't he at least not endorse Al Gore? So he's an interesting person in terms of the potential, in terms of the flaws and so on. And if you stopped and thought about how Lynn or one of you guys would write a dialogue which had that as its sub-theme, many of Plato's dialogues are very much of that quality. So it adds a real depth to understand the historical context within which these dialogues are located. And in particular, the question of the earlier generation of Straussians. So just to quickly, in much more brief form, locate the history that we're dealing with. Greece, if you take the 5th century B.C., from 500 B.C. to 400 B.C., you see both the absolute best of Greece and of Athens and the absolute worst of Athens. Because at the beginning of that century, in 490 B.C., and I'm not going to do the transparencies like I did last night, the Athenians and their allies defeated the greatest oligarchical army that had probably ever existed on the face of the planet. They defeated them at the Battle of Marathon. The Greeks were outnumbered 2-1, maybe 3-1, and the Persians in the previous years had conquered everything in sight, basically from India all the way through Turkey and Greece, down into Egypt, and so on. Nothing had been able to stop them. And then on the plain at Marathon, you had maybe 10,000 Greeks. You had about 11,000 Greeks up against 20 or 30,000 Persians. And in 2 days of fighting, the Greeks not only defeated the Persians, but the casualty lists just tell you something absolutely extraordinary. The Greeks lost 192 soldiers killed, and the Persians lost 6,400 killed. So you're dealing with a society which is obviously operating on with a power, with powers of conceptions, which was far, far superior to the Persians, and that translated into technology, that translated into what they were fighting for, that translated into leadership, and so on and so forth. 10 years later, the Persians tried again. This was a naval battle at Salamis, and once again, outnumbered, the Greeks defeated the Persians. Yet, less than 100 years later, in 404 BC, Athens had been defeated and destroyed as the result of a 30-year-long civil war, the Peloponnesian War. There was political madness in Athens during the Peloponnesian War, after the Peloponnesian War. You had Plato's uncle, for example, was among those who was installed by the Spartans, because it was the Spartans who defeated the Athenians. Plato's uncle, Critias, was installed at the end of the Peloponnesian War by the Spartans. This was called the Reign of the 30 Tyrants. And there were atrocities and executions carried out and so on. What role Critias played in them is not completely clear to me. It was not good. Was there anything else that could have been done at that time? Who knows? It was not a good situation. They were overthrown a year or so later by the Democrats. There were battles and there were assassinations and so on. They were overthrown a year or so later by the Democrats, by a so-called democratic regime, which a couple of years later executed Socrates in 399. So by the end of this century, Athens is a complete disastrous mess. And it had been going on for 10, 20, it basically had been going on through the entire duration of the Peloponnesian War. So the question which Plato is addressing, you know, as Lynn addressed, not in the form of dialogue, written dialogues, but obviously in the form of verbal dialogues, the question that Lynn is addressing is, where did the flawed axioms, what were the flawed axioms which led to the this complete internal destruction of Athens? Because ultimately it wasn't an external destruction. Spartan was ultimately the conqueror, but only because Athens had precipitated the war and caused this crisis, so it was internal. Now, the answer to that, in large part, comes, you have to go back to the previous century to identify where the flaw in axioms comes from. And that is the battle which is taking place in an area of Greek settlement, which is Italy. You had two contending forces in Italy in the 6th century. One was the Pythagoreans. And as I discussed in my article and discussed more directly last night, Pythagoras was essentially someone who was trained by the Egyptians and was part of an expansive colonization of ideas in science, astronomy, geometry, that the Egyptians had done in the previous centuries. The Egyptians knew they were under attack. Whether they knew there were too many, I sort of sometimes have the idea when you think about the Europeans after the Renaissance, who have the idea of the right kind of society. The idea of a community of principle, the idea of a republic, as Cusa talks about in his works and so on, yet they know they can't do it in Europe. They know they have to go someplace where they're away from all the feudal trappings, all the oligarchical manipulations and so on, and they have to colonize the American continent in order to actually have the freedom to develop these ideas and finally bring them into actuality. I have the feeling that this is what was going on among the Egyptian intelligentsia, that they knew they were never going to really be able to do this in Egypt, and so they had colonies on the Ionian coast of Turkey. They had colonies, Crete was a major Egyptian colony. Greece itself was, to a large degree, colonized, or at least certain ideas were imported into Greece by the Egyptians. And you had major Egyptian colonies in Italy as well. And Pythagoras was one of those deployments from the Egyptian intelligentsia and political leadership. He founded a community in Croton, which is on the mainland. I see Sam grabbed my article, so he's got the map here, which is a good idea. There were other colonies of other like-minded people in Italy. The Pythagoreans were very politically involved. There's a book I haven't read yet, but it's called The Political Life of the Pythagoreans in Italy. And they were engaged in combat, sometimes mental, I'm not sure if it was physical, but they were in a political battle with various city-states and so on to improve the leadership, to get rid of tyrants, to bring better ideas of government in and so on. It was a real political combat. Then you had you had deployed into Italy, more or less at the same time the Pythagoreans were deployed, you had the Eleatics. And in fact, the word Eleatic just comes from the place where they ended up, which was Elis. The main Eleatic that we all know is Parmenides. And again, this is where this is the origin of Straussianism. This is the origin of existentialism, because what Parmenides argues, and we do have his main philosophical work, which is a poem called The Way of the Truth. We don't have the whole thing, but we have enough of it to see what his epistemology is. What Parmenides' argument is that you cannot know the truth through your senses. Okay, well, so far so good, because that's what Plato says and that's what Lynn says. But Parmenides' conclusion is, therefore, you cannot know the truth. Or if you have any inkling of the truth, it's only because you've been inducted into a mystery, which his poem the goddess, I'm on the magnificent steeds with their rolling wheels, and we come up to the gates. I think the gates have two colors, you know, all sorts of pre-Freemasonic symbolism, you know, and I'm inducted in, and I find out, you know, that basically you cannot know anything. There is only the one. The one has no description. The one doesn't move. The one is nothing. So essentially you can't know it, and the goddess inducts me into these mysteries. He then goes on and says a few more things. But this is the foundation of Straussianism, that you cannot know the truth through your mind. Now, a derivative of that is a little cruder, and that is what came, what the sophists then concluded as a result of that, which is, well, if you can't know the truth with your mind, then there is no truth, so forget about it. But as you can see, if you look at the difference between the way Plato treats Parmenides in the Parmenides dialogue, which is easily his most challenging, his most rigorous dialogue in terms of taking a series of hypotheses and then just working through, you know, to the point of exhaustion, which you often are at some points in the Parmenides, working through to the point of exhaustion, the paradoxes embedded in this set of hypotheses, he takes Parmenides very, very seriously. Now, if you look at some of the dialogues which feature the sophists, who are, you know, the more crude version of this, as I was describing last night, some of the dialogues with the sophists, like Protagoras and Gorgias, are the most rambunctious, the Protagoras is one of the most humorous in terms of one of its settings. The Gorgias, at one point, you get the feeling they're going to break out in fist fights. I mean, they're very combative, and do deal rigorously with the paradoxes involved in the sophists' ideas and so on and so forth. But you can see that he takes Parmenides much, much more seriously, as a much more serious problem to deal with epistemologically than just somebody who just says there is no truth. That it's much more serious, it's much more dangerous for somebody to say there is truth but you can't know it. So he treats Parmenides much, much more seriously. Now, how do these ideas that there is no truth or that you can't know the truth, how do they get infected into Greek society? Plato's dialogues address this directly, because again, go back to what you obviously had in terms of a great society. The ability of the Athenians to defeat the Persians in 490 represents something. in the century before that, the same century as Pythagoras in Italy, you had Solon of Athens. Essentially, just to get these dates in your mind, Solon is about 100 years before the Battle of Marathon. Solon is 600 B.C. The Battle of Marathon is 490 B.C. Thales is about 100 years before the Battle of Marathon, the great astronomer and geometer. So you have this period between 600 B.C., the Battle of Marathon, the Battle of Salamis, the plays of Aeschylus. Aeschylus wins his first prize for playwriting, I think, in 477 or 476. I might be off a little bit. But somewhere in that period, Aeschylus wins his first prize. You know, I think consider them the greatest of all the Greek dramatists, Aeschylus and so on. So you're looking at a period of time from about 600 to 470 B.C., which, as I said last night, I consider the real class, the golden age of Greece, not the age of Pericles. You've created a great society. Egypt has played a major role in terms of this, in terms of drama, in terms of statecraft, in terms of technology, in terms of science, and so on. And think of it like the United States. I mean, we created a great nation. The American Revolution, the idea of the Constitution, the idea of a republic, the creation of a republic for the first time in history. The idea of the republic had been around since Plato. There were still problems to be solved, especially in terms of economy. There were obviously scientific breakthroughs that had to be made, like Kuz's breakthroughs and Kepler's breakthroughs. But the seed crystal of the idea of the republic, you know, was around in 2400 B.C. But there were still problems to be solved, and it wasn't until Western civilization solved them and our founding fathers solved them, and we established for the first time in history something where the idea of man being created in the image of God was then applied to statecraft and to economics simultaneously. That problem was finally solved with the American Constitution and the American Revolution, which is a direct outgrowth of classical Greece. One thing I'll just say as an aside, have you read the Laws yet?
No.
Some people have, some people haven't. But the Laws is really quite enjoyable, and I would recommend that you keep this principle in mind the next time you read the Republic. Because you go through about the first five books of the Laws, and remember, this is an Athenian stranger, probably Plato, in a discussion with a Spartan and a Cretan over a constitution for a new colony that they're talking about. And they're going into all sorts of elaborate discussions in terms of how you divide up the land, who governs, who has rights, who does this, who does that, and so on. And you're following this thing through, you know, the role of slaves. Again, there were a lot of problems that were not yet solved in this society. And then about halfway through the Laws, I think it's probably book six, but I haven't read it recently, the Athenian stranger says, but wait a minute, I think we forgot something here. None of this really works without a prelude. You have to have a prelude to your constitution or a preamble. And he said, you really can't actually seriously discuss this unless you have a conception which overarches the particulars of your constitution. And the conception he goes on to develop is that God is good, and that God has created the universe and has created mankind to continue this process of good and so on. And he develops this concept, which is also very much in the Timaeus. But at that point, the entire quality of the discussion in the Laws changes, because he's basically worked you through a whole simple hypothesis of how to organize society. And then he says, but wait a minute, you know, you forgot something. So you think about the question of the prelude. I mean, the minute I read this section about the prelude for the first time, I said to myself, you know the founding fathers had studied the Laws at that point. You absolutely know they'd studied the Laws. So you have this great, you know, nation which was developed in 1776. And even within 30 or 40 years, the United States is in a state of degeneration. If people have read many of James Fenimore Cooper's novels, and I think Mark has talked about those a lot, if I remember correctly. But there's one where Cooper has been in Europe in the late 1820s and the early 1830s, comes back to the United States and writes a novel called Home is Found, and he is horrified. Here you are 50 years after the American Revolution, and everyone's walking around trying to act like the British, dressing like the British, reading what the British read, you know, and so on. He's seen a real degeneration of this civilization. And this is what happens with Greece. You from the apex, you get an epistemological, a philosophical infection, and you get the destruction of this civilization. And the destruction comes in because the commitment of the Athenians, which had carried them through this struggle to understand the truth, to know the universe through your mind, which obviously was the key characteristic of Greek society from 600 to about 470, 460 BC, it's broken. One thing about the Battle of Marathon, unlike all the other Greek city-states, the Athenians were the only ones who didn't listen to the Oracle of Delphi. The Oracle of Delphi told all the other Athenian city-states, or all the other Greek city-states, to surrender to the Persians. They, as I said last night, they listened to Fox TV. You know, they listened to the Gallup poll, they listened to the opinion polls in March of 2000, which said the election is over. Never mind that there's only been one primary, and Gore and Bush are the candidates, so you might as well all stay home. So everybody in the United States in 2000 dutifully did that, and the election ended about March 2nd. In the United States, because Fox TV and the Oracle of Delphi told us that the election was over. Well, the Athenians were the only city-state that didn't listen to Fox TV, and therefore they did fight the Persians. By the time you get to the Peloponnesian War, the Athenians are listening to the Oracle of Delphi again. And that, in a sense, is the characteristic shift. No longer a commitment to the truth, but instead bowing to public opinion, the gods on Mount Olympus. And that infection was brought in through the Eleatics and the Sophists. And this is what Plato was writing about in many, many, many of his dialogues. Pericles, supposedly the leader of the Golden Age of Greece, was under the influence of Sophists, Protagoras, Gorgias. Protagoras was his main advisor. And Pericles was the person who decided that the Persians were no longer a threat and essentially disbanded the defense alliance called the Delian League, and then later, not too many years later, got sucked into fighting the Peloponnesian War, which destroyed Greece. So Plato's dialogues are very much a living history of where this infection came in terms of Greek policymaking, which led to the disastrous decision of the Peloponnesian War and the destruction of Athens and the execution of Socrates. So when I recommended last night this little book, there may be another one like it, but this is just called Who's Who in the Greek World. And most of the characters in Plato's dialogues, you know, you can just find a short little paragraph on them. It adds a tremendous depth to the dialogue if you actually locate it politically in terms of what he's talking about. As I mentioned last night, the Phaedo, which is the death of Socrates, the two key figures, the young men that he's having the most intense discussion with about the existence of the soul, Cebes and Simmias, are students of the most important second generation Pythagorean, Philolaus. So when you know that, it adds there's a real continuity of history that Plato would choose these two young men to be the key people having the discussion with Socrates. And in fact, at the end, you might remember the last comment of Socrates just before he dies as he turns to his friend, I think Crito, and he says, "Don't forget to sacrifice a cock to Asclepius." Asclepius was a Greek semi-deity who really was the Greek version of the Egyptian god Thoth, who was the god of learning, of letters, of wisdom, and so on. And it had something to do with medicine as well. But you know that Plato knows exactly what he's doing when the last words out of Socrates' mouth are to point you back again to Egypt once again. So, you know, there's a richness and a depth in this context. Now, that being said, you know, let's just move quickly and briefly to Alan Bloom, because you know, to rip these dialogues out of this political context, or to rip a section of the dialogue out of the context and the compositional method of the dialogue, you know, is simply the stock and trade of these guys. And, you know, what's their methodology? We're the classical scholars, you know, and if you don't believe me, I'm going to beat you over the head. Or if you don't believe me, you're never going to get tenured, and you're never going to pass, and you're never going to do anything. You know, and then you get to the little slightly more blunt version of these sophists and these Straussians, which is, if you don't believe me, I'm going to bomb your city, destroy your museums, and, you know, eliminate your heritage. But this is their stock and trade. And what Bloom does is just so incredibly transparent. I don't have the whole book with me. I had Dave Shaven just fax me a couple of pages from the introduction to his translation of The Republic. And True Confessions, I should tell you. When I first started looking at Plato, before I knew any Greek or really knew much of anything, I liked the Bloom translation because it, compared to somebody like Cornford, who he savages in his introduction, I mean, Cornford just takes sections out. He just turns, I mean, he just dies, you know, he sits there with the scalpel and he just chops it to pieces and so on.
Is that why in the Hamilton that we, I forget which dialogue it is, but you're reading the translation by Cornford and then all of a sudden they say, well, this paragraph is now done by Jowett.
Yeah, because he left whole stuff out. He actually eliminated the actual dialogue so that, you know, the back and forth is gone and it's just long, sometimes long monologues, you know, translated to bore you to absolute death. So, and I had read some other translation and actually I was trying to figure out at that point what the Greek modes were, because Lynn had made some reference to the Dorian mode, and I wanted to figure out what they were. So, and Plato talks about it in The Republic. So I was reading one translation, and the guy is trying to, I think it was some Brit, I don't think it was Cornford, and instead of using the word mode, which is a very conscious term, I mean, you're talking about the arrangement of steps, half steps and whole steps, you know, which defines an organization of a musical tetrachord, the guy I was reading uses the word tunes. You know, I mean, you're sitting there thinking, whistle a happy tune, you know, Bugs Bunny, and so on and so forth. I said, oh, this is horrible. So I picked up Bloom, and he at least translated it as modes and so on. And I read his introduction, and he said, well, I'm translating this literally. And I said, well, thank God, that's going to be better than this other stuff, and so on. So now Tony Papert, and this was maybe 15 years ago, and this was the only time I'd ever heard of Strauss. Tony Papert kept saying to me, but Alan Bloom is a Straussian. And I had no idea what he was talking about. And he said a few things, and it just didn't have any context, and I had no idea what he was talking about, and so on. So at a certain point, I just ended up putting Bloom aside because I was learning a little bit of Greek and had turned more to the Loeb editions, which have the Greek on the side of them. But that, you know, that True Confession aside, you know, it is seductive on first glance. But then you just go back and you reread the introduction, and here, I'll read you one part, and then I'll just briefly go through this one, the so-called noble lie section. Okay. The Platonic dialogues do not present a doctrine. They prepare the way for philosophizing. They are intended to perform the function of a living teacher who makes his students think, who knows which ones should be led further, and which ones should be kept away from the mysteries, and who makes them exercise the same faculties and virtues in studying his words as he would have to use in studying nature independently. I mean, that's Straussianism right there.
What does it mean, studying nature independently?
I don't know. I'd have to look at this out of in more of a context. At the end of, this is just the preface. It's about a 30-page preface. But typical of these Straussians, as Tony says, you then have a 120-page interpretive essay at the end of the book, at the end of the translation. So in case you read his translation and actually figured out what Plato was really saying, you can read the interpretive essay at the end so he can wipe your mind clear of any ideas that you might have had to, you know, reestablish a Straussian idea. So I don't know exactly the context, the previous context of this. I'd have to read the whole thing again, and I don't have it. Okay, so here's here's how he deals with the question of the noble lie. And this, again, is an attack on Cornford. He says, and this is almost illegible, in addition to the unawareness of the need for precision, that part of Cornford's problem is, you know, he just isn't precise, the unwillingness to accept certain unpalatable or shocking statements or teachings is another cause of deviation from literalness. This unwillingness is due either to a refusal to believe that Plato says what he means, or a desire to make him respectable. Cornford provides again a spectacular example of a not too uncommon tendency. At Book 3, 414, Socrates tells of the need for a noble lie to be believed in the city he and his companions are founding. And then he goes on to attack Cornford. Cornford calls it a boldful flight of invention, and so on and so forth. Then he continues, Bloom continues, this whole question of lying has been carefully prepared by Plato from the very outset, starting with the discussion with old Cephalus. It recurs again with respect to the lies of the poets and the assertion that the gods cannot lie and that the rulers may lie. And he cites the actual references. Now, this is an earlier reference to this, and this is in Book 2 of the Republic, where he first introduces this question. He introduces the question of lying. And this is one of the places where Bloom and the Straussian says he's talking about a noble lie. And let's see, I can't even remember if it's Adeimantus or Glaucon at this point. But Socrates says, don't you know that here's the point at which everybody translates it, noble lie. Don't you know that the veritable lie, if the expression is that the noble lie, if the expression is permissible, is a thing that all gods and men abhor? Anybody see him endorsing the idea in that sentence? And first of all, it's not even noble. It's simply truthful, a truthful falsehood, which is an interesting concept, which is making you think about a paradox. But he's saying, isn't this something that all gods and men abhor? And he continues to say that through the rest of this little section. This is 382A, right at the beginning of 382A. So the first time he introduces this, when they claim they're translating it as noble lie, it's not even noble lie, it's truthful lie, and it's in the context of saying it's abhorrent, nobody should actually do it. But then it gets introduced again, and this is the more substantive place where these guys always go crazy about this. And first, I mean, there's all sorts of embedded ironies, and I would just recommend that you reread the entire argument up to this point. The place where it's introduced again is in 414 B and C in Book 3. And first of all, there's, I think, something absolutely ironic at this point, because here's the sentence that these guys get off on. How then might we contrive one of those opportune falsehoods of which we were just now speaking, so as by one noble lie to persuade, if possible, the rulers themselves, but failing that, the rest of the city? And then, what kind of fiction do you mean? And he goes on and tells the story of the Phoenician myth of how the Thebans sprang up from dragon's teeth from the ground, and so on and so forth. But first of all, I noticed as we were rereading the Republic again in our Plato group, and I noticed that the word that, remember, the Straussians developed the difference between the philosophers and the gentlemen. They love this idea of gentlemen. And as Bloom points out, the word for gentleman that they're taking from the Greek is the word genios, which just means, you know, it's the word for a birth, race, and so on, but its implication in the Greek language is gentleman. Or good breeding, I think that's a better term of it. Plato, actually, the first time I noticed him using the word in the Republic, he uses it in relationship to a dog. So I think it's actually a very ironic term. And in fact, I think the entire first section of the Republic, you have to take in the context of a set of hypotheses and axioms he set up at the beginning, and he's working through the implications of these hypotheses and axioms, sort of like in the Laws, where you work through this elaborate structure for how you organize society, and then at a certain point, the Athenian stranger says, but wait a minute, we seem to have forgotten something, and you end up with a higher hypothesis at that point in the Laws. So if you look at the first couple of books of the Republic from that standpoint, that there's a set of hypotheses that have been set up, and I don't think it's irrelevant that the first use of the word genios has to do with a dog, might give you a hint to what might be wrong with the set of hypotheses that we're working through at this point. So you can't forget the context within which this is. The other thing which is absolutely striking is as Socrates goes on to, well, let me then back up again. Then the context just previous to this is what they're actually talking about is, again, choosing the guardians. But again, they're choosing them within a certain set of axioms that they've already established. But choosing guardians who cannot be fooled, who cannot be persuaded by force to give up their commitment to the city, who cannot be seduced by mysteries, who have a certain firmness of mind, who know what their principles are, and who will stick to their principles. And what Socrates has just gone through is, well, then don't we have to put the guardians to some kind of test to see which ones can remain firm to truthful principles and which one might be seduced by lies. That's the entire context for the introduction of this section. It's so to pull this out of context and say, oh, well, this means that you can tell noble lies and that's how you're going to govern your society, takes the whole thing completely out of context. And then dramatically, what's very interesting next is that Socrates is encouraged to give an example of one of these fictions or myths and so on. And the one that he brings up is the Phoenician myth, which is the idea that the people of Thebes were born of springing out of the earth full-blown because somebody threw dragon's teeth on the ground and so on. Now, again, in context, the Thebans were always considered a really wretched part of Greek society. They were always messing things up, allying with the Persians and so on. So the fact that you're talking about the Thebans is not lost in terms of the fact that this is the myth about how the Thebans started. And dramatically, it's very interesting because Socrates says, he brings up the Phoenician myth, his partner, and again, I don't remember if it's Glaucon or Adeimantus, if anybody knows for sure, but anyway, he says, you act like one who shrinks from telling his thought. And Socrates said, you will think I have a good right reason for shrinking when I have told you. And the other guy says, say on and don't be afraid. In other words, he's actually got to drag this out of Socrates. Socrates doesn't particularly want to tell this story. So you have to think of the whole thing in context. And for the Straussians to build their entire epistemology on the idea of the noble lie, when there are about five layers of context, composition, and irony embedded in getting up to that point in the Republic, you know, is just typical of one of these, what one of these guys would actually do. That's 414 B, C, and D, essentially. And again, I would just say that, I'm sure you've already discovered this in one form or another in terms of reading Plato. The most fun is when you're getting to a point in Plato and you're sitting there saying, does he really mean that? You know, and then Plato's got you. I mean, that's exactly the response that should be evoked. And, you know, that's the process of dialogue, the process of paradox. It's rife throughout the Republic. Every time we've read it, and those of us who've been in the group since the beginning, this is probably number 4 that we've actually read it, you know, those of who, us who have experienced this a number of times, we just sort of get to books two and three and sit back and say, okay, now we get to watch people bounce off walls, mm-hmm. you know, for the next couple of weeks. Because, you know, Plato wants you to be upset. Plato wants you to challenge him, wants you to challenge the axioms. He wants you to challenge all of these things. And that, of course, is the actual context of this. And for Bloom to say, oh, no, this is not a doctrine, but there are secret meanings, and if you know the secret code, you know, you'll be able to understand that he really is in favor of the noble lie and so on, you know, is absolutely outrageous. Now, I'll just mention one other thing and then open it up to questions. We did have a Straussian in our organization. He was an American, but posted in Germany for a long time. His name was George Gregory. He's done some translations in the Schiller book, and including in the new Schiller book, and before they were published, Lynn was asked if they were adequate, and he said they were. Skip quit some time ago, I don't know how long ago, but he ran a Plato seminar in our Wiesbaden headquarters for years and years and years. And I once had someone staying at my house who was in this seminar. And I didn't understand the Straussian question at the time, but now that I know what Strauss was, it's obvious. This guy said to me, "Well, you know, we spent 4 weeks on the first page of the Republic." I said, "Huh?" I mean, we spent 2 or 3 weeks on some very challenging sections in the Parmenides, because you have to keep going back and reestablishing the context and working the paradox through and so on. I said, "Huh?" And he said, "Look, you've got to understand, the whole key to the Republic is in the first part of the Republic, where they say that, actually I think they spent 3 weeks on the first sentence, where Socrates says, I went down yesterday to the Piraeus with Glaucon, and because it turns out this is a totally Straussian argument. This was argued by a professor at St. John's University. Because there is no particle, because it does not say to the Piraeus, and frankly, it's a completely bogus argument because particles are often not used with proper names and so on. But the Straussian argument is because there is no particle, that means something mysterious. And there's an entire article written about this, and the mysterious thing is it means actually you're coming down from, or the use of the preposition ace. It's some wacky argument that you're coming down from or up from the Piraeus, and it really means you're coming from Hades. And the real secret is, you know, they're coming out of the mysteries or they're going into the mysteries and so on, and this is what defines the entire Republic. And as I say, at that time I didn't know what Strauss was. I mean, I kind of remembered what Tony had said to me about Bloom, but I didn't connect that with this. And I said, "That sounds a little crazy." He said, no, you have to understand absolutely every word. I said, "That would be like kind of stopping at bum, 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 you know, in the Fifth Symphony, and never getting to the end." So this Straussian methodology is completely wacky. It is antithetical to anything that Plato stands for, which, you know, you can get from reading his Simplest Dialogue. So with that, let me open it up for questions on anything having to do with Plato.
Carl Jaspers wrote a letter to the Denazification Committee saying that Martin Heidegger should not be allowed to teach students anymore in Germany because his method was so, would induce such a trance-like state in the students. He was so powerful and just spellbinding the students who had not developed their own independent powers of thinking yet. That the students' really only choice was to just submit to this guy as a master. And I guess Carl Jaspers said Heidegger's intention is not to develop independent thinking in his kids, but he should be banned from teaching. And his method is Heidegger, that's Heidegger's. Strauss came up with his interpretation of text from Heidegger.
Mm-hmm.
He was a young man. He was one of these brainwashies of Heidegger
mm-hmm.
who attended his lectures. And it was totally just like seduced very erotically
mm-hmm.
by this. Heidegger would stand up at the front of the lecture room with his probably his little mustache and all black. Black turtleneck, long, you know, black pants, black shoes, boots, or whatever. And just stand up there, and he'd interpret, he'd go through it, the sentence structure, one sentence, the number of words in the text, the key words and ideas being, you know, the halfway point in terms of the total number of words and the whole thing. And this is where Strauss gets it.
Yeah. And I mentioned this last night, but when I was first trying to figure out Parmenides as a person, as a historical person, I went and looked up to see what books there might be written that I could get my hands on. And all the 20th century books on the Eleatics and the Parmenides are written by Heidegger, Hannah Arendt, Karl Popper, Nietzsche, and so on. Because Parmenides gives them the philosophical foundation they need, that the truth is not knowable. There are mysteries you can be inducted into, but the truth is not knowable. So when I was in Detroit, Carrie Lowry said, you know, the Eleatics, I really didn't understand what this was. He had William Yandell Elliott's son's obituary, the obituary the son wrote for his father. He went and pulled it off the internet for me, and his son, and I guess this might be the guy that Danny met, I don't know.
Yeah,
and he says, you know, he says William Yandell Elliott was a true Eleatic. So that's what, I mean, that... This fundamental question that you cannot know the truth is the it is the fundamental dividing line between us and them, and it's really sort of the difference between fascism and people who have a set of bad axioms, you know, because a lot of people have bad axioms. They think you know the truth with your senses, you know, they interpret it in different ways and so on. But there's this unbridgeable gap between bad, you know, people who simply have bad axioms and people who say you cannot know the truth. Yeah.
You notice this in a lot of Plato's dialogues. Everyone in the room, except for Socrates, will be totally entranced by whatever the speaker is saying. They'll be so eloquent and so magical and powerful and seductive in their language and their ideas. But everyone will be totally stupefied and just think, wow, this guy's really smart. I got to figure out what this guy's saying. But Socrates always is kind of there and just like, well, but back in the very beginning of what you said, I noticed this one thing. I mean, what do you think it is that allows, what is Socrates looking for? How does he not allow himself first to get totally schrammerized by the totally ridiculousness but complexity of the arguments? Because it also happens to us in organizing, especially on campuses. I've seen organizers, including myself, get completely thrown off course by some wacko who's waxing eloquent about Nietzsche, and they intimidate you. They don't reason with you. They intimidate you intellectually into thinking you can't argue against them, that they know the material better than you do. And why doesn't Socrates get intimidated? What is his passion?
Well, it's like Lynn, right? And, you know, Lynn, I mean, how many times does somebody ask Lynn a question? And as opposed to what most of us would be tempted to do, which is to start to answer the shadows. You know, someone throws some shadows at you, and you start shadow boxing with the shadows, right? You know, what Lynn does is, you know, immediately, he knows what the person is actually, he knows what's generating the shadows that he has to answer to actually give a truthful response to that person. You know, so it's the phenomenon, you know, that most of us have finally figured out where we actually resist the temptation of saying to ourselves, he didn't answer the question. Because he actually is, and he's answering the real question, the generative principle which is causing the shadows. And it's, I mean, Lynn's mind is always in the continuous domain. His mind, he lives in the continuous domain. He don't live down here where most of us keep getting stuck most of the time. And he's always answering questions from the standpoint of how can I get you up here in the continuous domain where I am? And Socrates is the same thing. Now, obviously, the passion is you're not going to live in the continuous domain unless you love mankind. I mean, because that's what the continuous domain is. It's the simultaneity of eternity. You know, you're in a dialogue with all of humanity past and future. That's where you live. That's who you are. Your identity is that. Your identity is not something discrete. It's not something physical. You know, it's not in the shadow world. So that's where Lynn lives. That's where Plato has Socrates live. So he's always up there in the continuous domain, aware of how the shadows are being generated.
Actually,
yeah.
Jonathan had worked through a little group of us in Berlin, and he had read through like the part where Thrasymachus comes into the conversation in the Republic, and he read like this little part where Socrates describes how, you know, he kills him because you had the conversation, you know, he had all these guys. I mean, it was really a conversation between two or three people, but you had a whole grouping surrounding, right? You had a whole group of people. And Socrates said how he, out of the corner of his eye, he could notice that Thrasymachus was becoming agitated. I could see, like, Thrasymachus just getting really, kind of like, holding himself back from jumping in, but kind of, like, getting agitated. You could see, like, the look in his eyes, and see him break out in sweat, and, like, you know, just, you know, twitch or whatever. And so that when Thrasymachus actually bursts through the crowd, comes in yelling, everyone was terrified, except for Socrates. And Socrates admits that if he hadn't have noticed that out of the corner of his eye, he paid attention to Thrasymachus the whole time. He knew that that's something Thrasymachus would do. And so he said, because I paid attention through the whole conversation, you know, I was talking to this guy over here, getting my eye out for this guy. And when Thrasymachus did jump in, Socrates was able to not react to it. He knew that was a part of the character.
He says, because I looked him in the eye.
Yeah, sort of.
Hello? You have a question, Sam Leandro?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I couldn't really hear him. But it wasn't the Socratic method in when you're out organizing. This is something which sometimes gets me into trouble because I start asking a few questions and then before I know it, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I'm just confusing the poor person. And I just keep asking question after question. But sometimes... and the real question was, I don't know what Socrates is doing. I don't know whether he understands already where that person is coming from and sort of ask the questions and lay sort of a trap to get them to see how they're thinking as well. I think, sometimes I think he's doing that. And sometimes that's something I do, that I can do. Not always, but when I kind of know the person, they can come into a few meetings. But then the other one, I don't know if Socrates is asking to really know what's inside of their mind, and to then be able to sort of make sort of a graph where that person can see their backwardness. I'm not sure which one of the two, maybe it's doing both, but it's sort of hard to understand.
Well, I think the dialogues are composed in such a way that, I mean, Plato knows that there's a certain set of axioms he wants to deal with in terms of the dialogue. So I think there's a very deliberate compositional method so that Socrates is in a position to... I mean, he knows who these guys are. Plato knows who these guys are. They've seen what they're doing to society already. It's like Lynn. I mean, Lynn, you know, Lynn knows the characteristic of a question just from the curvature, just from the shape of a question. You know, he's got an insight into the mind of the person just from the standpoint of how they ask the question. And that's, you know, that's where, I mean, that takes, again, constantly being in the continuous domain when you're talking to people. And that's how you don't get lost, you know, in terms of confusing people. And, you know, I mean, look, Lynn, it's so obvious. Every single thing he says at this stage, whether he's talking to a reporter, whether he's talking to a cadre school, whether he's talking to businessmen in Milan and so on, I mean, he says it over and over again. He always establishes the difference between man and animal. He knows that unless he has established that axiomatic difference, then, you know, there's no way he's going to be able to deal with the person that he's talking to. And I find whenever I'm organizing somebody on the phone, you know, and I get in one of these loops, you know, where you're butting heads and you're shadow boxing and so on, I usually just take a deep breath, step back, and say, you know, wait a minute, and then try and reestablish that as the subject. And you know, then show the person that what they're saying is a result of an axiom that they're treating man as an animal. Sometimes people say, oh, yeah, man is an animal. You know, you've got to work them through whether they really mean that or not. But whenever I get myself, you know, tangled up and I'm about to trip over, take the cue from Lynn. I mean, if you haven't established that as your fundamental distinction, then you're likely to end up in a labyrinth with no way out. But I think in terms of the dialogue, I think Plato is composing them such that Socrates is, it's like Lynn, he's on the hunt. He's always on the hunt for the specific axiom he wants to demolish. It's like I said last night, I mean, when Lynn, obviously we knew about, some people knew about Strauss before, Tony Papert knew about Strauss, Lynn knew about Strauss, he mentioned Strauss in the November Cadre School. I don't know if people remember that. I don't know if it was Philadelphia or California. Whoever had a cadre school in November, I think it might have been Philadelphia.
Yes.
And I was looking at the Q&A for some reason, and right there he actually mentioned Strauss in November. Now, it didn't become... then it got brought up again in some context by an intelligence source, but it was like, as I said, it was like Lynn, like a heat-seeking missile. You know, he was looking for the specific diagnosis of the fascist virus that he needed to make clear to people that this was not just bad axioms, this was fascism. And I think Socrates is very much like that. He's on the hunt. He's hunting for the bad axioms.
Stephen?
Yeah.
Another question. We're reading through the Lodge right now, book six. They're really good. It sort of reminds me of how we get into long discussions about things with people at the cadre school about the technicalities of New Bretton Woods or the land bridge.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what the Lodge are like. But I don't know if it's Dr. Bloom, but I have a book from the library where one of these two guys goes through the Lodge, and each book they just have a small paragraph of it, and I was curious whether you think it's okay to try and work through that, if it's actually worthwhile.
Well, I wouldn't read any. I wouldn't read anything secondary. I wouldn't read anybody's commentary while you're reading it, if that's what you're asking. I don't know who these guys are, but I just wouldn't read anybody's commentary, because there's almost nobody who approaches this from a Gaussian standpoint as we do. So skip the commentaries. I mean, we read the footnotes and the lobes sometimes for kicks. I mean, because they are so outrageous.
Could you, I brought this up with maybe here, could you elaborate on this character that's from the Theaetetus of Socrates, the statesman, the stranger, because he is identified as
an Iliad. Yeah. I have to reread those from the stamp, I have to reread those before I could really say anything on that. My what I remember, and that's a series I haven't read probably for 2 years, It's sort of like Parmenides. My sense is Plato's making them better than they are. I don't think the Iliadic stranger is an Iliadic. From what I remember of some of the dialogue, he may be called an Iliadic stranger, but I actually don't think he is Iliadic in terms of his philosophy. But I'd have to rework him again. In the Parmenides, I really think he makes Parmenides better than he is. I mean, he actually gives him a little more substance than you find in Parmenides' poem.
And even this word, according to Leslie's earlier translation back in the 90s, she says that stranger is not exactly the right word. It's more like comrade or whatever,
friend
or something
comrade.
Like that.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Is it Xenos? Is that what they use for stranger? I actually don't remember. I'd have to look at it. Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, because that's one of the things that... see, it's funny, because you have Hannah Arendt and these other existentialists and what's his name who writes The Death of Socrates?
I.F. Stone.
I mean, on the one hand, you have one group of the oligarchy which takes the idea of Philosopher King and the idea of universal principles that you would lead as... I mean, the point of a Philosopher King in Plato is that he's saying, look, you've got to guide your society on the basis of universal principles. That's what has to guide your society. And he's basically looking around at his society and he's saying, well, you know, who is susceptible of actually guiding on universal principles? Now, this is 400 B.C. You don't have universal education. You've still got slavery. It's not a slave-based society. There's a difference between a society based on slavery and a society that has slavery. You don't have, you know, there's key breakthroughs in science and technology and so on which actually allow for the actual implementation of the idea of promoting the general welfare in terms of economic growth and so on. So it's not a perfect society. So you have Plato looking around and saying, how are you going to govern your society on the basis of universal principles? Well, we're going to have to train one person, a philosopher king, or we're going to have to train a group of guardians. Because to him, I think it was the only way, although obviously the idea of the republic has within it the seed crystal that you need for what we now know as a republic. But I think you have to look at it from the standpoint of Plato trying to answer the question that the most fundamental question is governing your society in accordance with universal principles. So who is going to be trained to know those universal principles? And did not, I believe, have the solution of training a population to do that at that point. Although it's implicit, because look at the Meno. He takes a slave boy with no education and shows that he does have the capacity to understand principles. So it's there, the seed crystal is there, but the actual working it out, elaboration, you know, it took another 1,000 or 2,000 years. You know, if you look at Cusa, you know, as the next major breakthrough after Plato, if you go from Plato to Cusa to the Constitution, I mean, it would be a very interesting study in the history of how mankind solves a problem in terms of how it should govern itself.
So, could you continue that thought on how the this one group of the older group takes and perverts these perceptions and started that?
Oh, I was just saying, it just occurred to me. On the one hand, you have Hannah Arendt and I of Stone claiming Socrates is a dictator because he believes in universal principles and you have to submit to those universal principles. And then on the other hand, you've got the Straussians who say, he believes there aren't any universal principles. So, you know, you just end up with two different perversions from this group of existentialists. Yeah, Anna. It's the first in writing that we know of. I mean, did somebody else do it before? Not that I'm aware of. I mean, you had the great tragedies of Aeschylus. You had the epic poetry of Homer, but those weren't dialogues. So to my knowledge, yes. I mean, maybe there's something in another language. Maybe there's something in Chinese that I don't know about. There could be. But to my knowledge, it's the first time you actually have this method of dialogue in a written in this form. I wouldn't say it's the best. I would say it has, it plays an indispensable role. But would you say that dialogue is better than poetry or better than drama? I wouldn't say that. You know, they're different mediums for addressing the same question. But I think from the standpoint of making knowable to the mind the actual processes of the mind, making very conscious how the mind itself actually works. It's that is its unique characteristic.
Sort of revisit this because one of the problems with the dialogues, I mean, you've said it a couple of times.
Speak up, please.
You can try to revisit it. The con- constant problem of getting two pages into a dialogue and then, okay, now what does he mean by this? And could he really mean this? I think that's worth sort of perhaps just going over again in different ways, because we've got this new Plato group, and it might be good to try in some way to at least inoculate a little bit against this. That's the first thing. Second thing is, if you can discuss the relationship between the historic Socrates and the historic Plato, if you know anything about it. Because I find it interesting that the historic Socrates fought in the Peloponnesian Wars, that reputation is that perhaps shaped his background. Who shaped Socrates?
Socrates, I really, outside of having read Xenophon's description of the life of Socrates, which pretty much says that, I actually don't know that much about Socrates. I mean, it's clear that Plato was forged in the crucible of Socrates' execution. I mean, Plato is who Plato is, because he was a student of Socrates, and the execution of Socrates was one of those transformative moments in all of mankind for him. I mean, the death of Socrates is sublime. And in a sense, if you're not looking at Plato's dialogues from the standpoint of that is what generated them and that is what shaped them. Because as I said last night, Plato was from a relatively well-off family and he was going to go into traditional politics. I mean, God, you think traditional politics are bad here. I mean, really, what was going on in Athens at the time was unbelievably horrible. You know, you had McCarthyite witch hunts, you know, you had executions. One of the things historically about Socrates, which is very important, there was a naval battle that was lost in 405 or 404 BC. The battle was won, but there was a storm, and the generals who were in charge of the Athenian fleet, because there was this great storm, could not save their wounded in the water because they would have lost everything in the storm. So they won this very, very important battle, but they couldn't save the wounded. This was considered a capital crime. So Socrates was on assembly which passed laws and made decisions and so on, and then there was a smaller group within that, and I can't remember how many were in it and what its name was. But Socrates served on that for a period of time, and he was on that smaller body when these generals were brought before them, and he fought against this absolutely insane law that these guys had to be executed. These were their best generals. They just won a naval battle. They were in a situation which was absolutely impossible. They would have lost the entire navy, and he fought to save them, and they were all executed.
He was the only one.
Yeah.
The entire.
Yeah.
Group.
Yeah.
It was had a different life. Huh? When he was told to bring in somebody for execution, and he refused to do it.
So I mean, he obviously, you know, I mean, the charges against him, you know, corrupting the youth, not paying homage to the gods, and so on and so forth. I mean. He was executed because he was like Lyndon LaRouche. I mean, he just was not going to bend. He was going to stick to this principle. So, you know, the manner of his death, as Plato records it in the Phaedo, I mean, that's who Plato is. Plato is defined, I think, by that moment. And that's where the passion comes from. I mean, the passion which infuses the importance of these dialogues, which is to ensure that a society does not make a horrible mistake like that again. And I mean, again, on the other question, you just have to keep exercising yourself as you read these dialogues. I mean, you can't help yourself, but just be conscious of the fact that, you know, as right now going again through the Republic, this is the first time I'm finally getting a sense that I'm getting a sense of the overall compositional method, you know, as opposed to this interesting part, this important part, this extremely important idea which is developed here, and so on. But the whole thing is a composition. There's a compositional method. And he sets up, you know, again, these first several books, he set up a series of axioms. If you remember how this whole beginning, after they deal with Thrasymachus, and then Socrates is getting on to the more serious discussion with Adeimantus and Glaucon, because they said, all right, well, we've just figured out what justice isn't. You know, it's not the might makes right. They say, I still don't really think I know what justice is. So that's the entry point for the second part of Book 2 and all of Book 3. So Socrates, at that point, sets up a hypothesis. He says, well, we're having trouble looking at justice in the large. You know, we're having trouble figuring out what this is. So, or no, we're having trouble looking at justice in the small. So maybe if we look at something bigger, we're going to be able to figure it out. So instead of looking at what is just from the standpoint of the individual, let's look at justice for the entire city. So let's start to construct this city. Now, does anybody remember what the hypothesis is by which he actually constructs this city?
Everybody has their own job.
It's totally utilitarian. You know, it's on the basis of, well, we will have these utilitarian needs, and these utilitarian needs must all be fulfilled, and you can only be good at one thing. I mean, that's the hypothesis in all of Book 2 and Book 3. So, you know, when you're sitting there scratching your head, wait a minute, he's saying you can't read Homer? You know, if you have a poet who shows up at your city who's good at more than one kind of poetry, more than one kind of art, you say to him, well, gee, that's very nice, but this city is not for you. You know, go to another city. You know, you're sitting there saying, huh? What is he talking? And then think of what he gets to later in the Republic, where he develops hypothesis, higher hypothesis, and hypothesis of higher hypothesis. So what he's exercising you on in the beginning of the Republic is working through a hypothesis and running into what all the paradoxes are and so on, and then forcing you to find a higher hypothesis to go back and solve the problems of the hypothesis he's put forward. Yeah, Danny, or Nick.
I think it's intended, like you said earlier. You get to the hypothesis, you get to more of the method of investigation later in the Republic. But you're not supposed to get there without freakouts.
That's right.
I think the freakouts in the discussions that we have are a necessary part of actually what Plato intends for us in order to understand. Because then when you reach that part of the dialogue, and you reach his, let's say, it's almost like you're freaking out with Plato a little bit. Because you're freaking out, and then you're realizing there's something wrong. What's going on? And at the same time, Socrates and the characters are figuring out, we've got to do something different here. You and your own mind are having the same kind of crisis. This happens when you read LaRouche's papers. If you read them closely, right, you know, when you're actually in a mode of, like, really concentrating, it is a dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
It is a dialectician, I guess. I mean, it's sort of like poets. You know, but you're reading, and you'll come to the end of a paragraph, and you'll ask yourself a question. To say, what is he talking about here? What does this mean? This doesn't make sense. Or something like that. And then within a couple pages or a few sections, Lynn will actually resolve the paradox or the crisis you've been in earlier. It's as if you're sitting in a room with, and not as a magical thing either, but it's as if you are having a dialogue. So, not to be just, not to quibble or anything, I think some of this stuff we have to actually, I think it's good. I don't think it's necessarily bad that there is this, what is he talking about? Seems pretty lawful.
Yeah, it's the best part of it. No, you're right, because he actually wants you to experience not just intellectually but emotionally, you know, the paradoxes of being stuck in a hypothesis. Yeah.
I had a quick question on the. This is Robert up in Camden.
Yeah.
On the this idea of the hypothesis, higher hypothesis, and what Lynn has always said. You mentioned that in the Republic. I mean, I've always, you know, been trying to look for where Lynn has said it's in Plato, and I've always tried to look for, okay, where? You know, in this big 1,500-page book, where does he say, okay, now I'm going to discuss hypothesis, higher hypothesis? So, on the one hand, I could ask a completely blocked literal question, which is, where is it? Otherwise, you know, if it's the idea of the whole Republic, then that's one of the things.
So. Well, it is the idea of the whole. I mean, the whole republic is an exercise in the actual that actual method. It's either in book 5 or book 6, I can't remember, but there is an actual discussion about hypothesis, and the Greek word is hypothesis. It's around the cave section. I think it's after the cave section. But the books 5 and 6 are, in a sense, the key transition point in the Republic, and it's somewhere in there. But the whole thing is an exercise in that entire method. And when you think of it compositionally, which is what's so evil about Bloom, I mean, the idea that you've got a compositional method, that it is this kind of exercise of your mind, is obviously what they're trying to kill. Yeah.
We're using this Edith Hamilton collection for our current reading.
We've used the Loeb in the past, just because enough of us know enough Greek that we can constantly look and say, you know, the first question is not did he really mean that, but is that actually what Plato is saying in terms of the translation. But we've recently found a translation which I like, which is hard to get. It's a 19th century translator of Plato called Henry Carey without the E, C-A-R-Y. He's also translated Dante. Obviously, he's a very extraordinary translator of different languages. This is part of something which was available to most Americans in the 19th century. It was called Bohn's Classical Library, B-O-H-N apostrophe S. And one of my friends happens to have the entire Plato. She's very lucky. I've got two volumes of it. I've got the Timaeus, the Republic, and then the Theaetetus, the Death of Socrates, the Symposium, I think, and so on. The guy is literate. I mean, the guy is literate, and he's not trying to screw you. I mean, that's what, you know, what sort of sold me was his translation in the Theaetetus of the Dunamis section, where he does not translate it as square roots. He translates it as powers. Now, I don't think he understood the geometry, because he gets about three-quarters of the way through that section, and then he flubs it. But I think it's because he didn't understand the geometry, not that he's trying to beat the life out of a concept. But again, the one thing I said last night is, don't forget, Lynn read the Parmenides in the worst translation possible, and he understood it. Because it's not in the words.
So the, if you can't get the, maybe we couldn't come up with a Carey translation, maybe very hard to do. You're saying reading is an essential use of the Loeb, that we can get by with what we're doing, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's individual moments when you get a deeper insight because of the Loeb, or where you actually catch the particular lie of the trans. I mean, you just start from the assumption that all 20th century translations of Plato lie deliberately. So, you know, you just start from that standpoint. So, you know, you might catch the particular lie and so on. But if you're thinking of it, you know, as Lynn would read something, you know, he picks up a fragment, he reads a bad translation, he knows what the author is saying because he's already got the idea of what the characteristic of the person's mind is. So, I mean, we find the Carey translation good, more fun at this point, because it's much better English, and he's not deliberately trying to mess up the translation. It's actually challenging. It's challenging to read it because it's a denser, you know, kind of Keats Shelley type of language. Our Xerox in the National Center is broken. But once it's fixed, I can make try and get a copyable copy of what we at least have already copied out here. Because it certainly doesn't hurt to read an enjoyable translation, but it's not essential. Oh, yeah. In other words, if we scanned it in.
Yeah, or
That would be an excellent idea, because it would be, because right now it's a Xerox of a Xerox, and it was already small type. We realized for us old folks we had to blow it up to 120%. But yeah, we could. I think Covici could probably scan it. I mean, there'll be some mistakes, because whenever he scans, you run into some problems. But if we'd actually got him to scan this stuff, then it would be available to everybody. An idea. I mean, I don't know. We got what copyright questions we got to worry about. It certainly can be available.
In 1800s,
yeah.
Any.
Yeah.
Is the Moon translation useful at all, or is it willfully fraudulent beyond his practice?
Yeah, it's willfully. I mean, it's seductive, so I'd rather actually read, I'm not sure I'd rather read Cornford. Cornford is pretty bad. Is it Cornford or the other bastard who translates Parmenides in there? Jowett?
No.
Yeah. Which one is it? Anyway. But no, Bloom, I mean, you know, it's one thing to try and beat the life out of an idea. It's another thing to actually try and kill Plato. And that's what Bloom is doing.
It's Cornford.
I was saying last night, the thing that finally provoked me to start to study Greek was when I discovered that the concept of to be, or existence, or that which is, the participle for to be in Greek is on, or ousia. One is neuter, one is feminine. Actually, and they have a shade of difference in terms of meaning. But so you're dealing with something like that which is, you know, that which exists. You're dealing with a concept. And when I discovered that Cornford, every time that concept was presented, translated as thing, I decided I'd better learn some Greek. Yeah.
Do you think you should speak Greek on Mars?
It's a beautiful language. My pronunciation is awful. Tony's is very good. And it's beautiful. I think we could improve our command of English and the way we speak English if more of us were literate in Greek. Does anybody know, did Shakespeare know Greek? Does anyone know?
Probably Smalley.
Yeah. Because whenever you find somebody who actually transforms their language.
Well, Shelley.
Yeah, yeah. But whenever you find somebody who actually transforms their language, takes the actual language and gives it a deeper, richer conception, it's because they're often bringing ideas in from another language.
What did you say, Ted?
Yes, the school he went to in Stratford, they taught Greek. That's all. Well, is that confusing?
No, nobody heard you.
But well, just one other thing on Greek. Remember, Greek comes from Sanskrit. I mean, Greek is an Indo-European. Is it?
What's the verdict on Shakespeare? We couldn't hear up here.
Yes, it's in Shakespeare was inaudible. No, the answer was yes. Shakespeare did have some Greek in his school. But, you know, Sanskrit is another language which comes from the same language base as Greek, which is very much of a sung language. That is, you've actually got pitch, you've got a musicality embedded in the language where you have different pitches. You know, whether they're thirds and fifths or whatever, I'm not sure we actually know. You have longs. What you have in Greek is longs and shorts, so that you have long vowels and you have short vowels. So if you think about a poem, you know, which is based on a certain meter, long, short, short, long, short, short, that's right there in the Greek language. A word will be pronounced long, short, short, not stress, unstress, unstress, but long, short, short. So you already have that embedded in the language, and then you have the question of pitch. that there are three pitches in the Greek language. So you've already got a musical composition in the language itself. And you just think of the challenge of you're composing a poem in which you're taking the embedded musicality of the language and then you're intensifying it through the actual composition of it. Sanskrit was another language like that. Some of the Oriental languages still have that pitch question in them. You know, if you say it at a higher pitch or a lower pitch, you know, you're either saying birdcage or, you know, screw your mother. I mean, you have to know what pitch, you know, you're dealing with. So, so there are other languages, but whether we need to speak Greek on Mars or not, or whether we need to speak Sanskrit on Mars, or whether we need to just speak better English on Mars, yeah.
Chapman is a contemporary from Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Hello. Speak up, please.
Chapman's Homer.
16th. Chapman is contemporary of Shakespeare. So if you get an idea of what English is, what's being done to English by translating Chapman's Homer, you see the relationship between the English and the Greek.
Yeah.
Because he does it the best.
Now last night I was reading Chapman's a section from Chapman's Homer versus what Alexander Pope did, and I was being tortured.
Yes.
Because you have Chapman who goes through this beautiful thing where he says Odysseus. I can't repeat it, but basically the 14 lines that Chapman created to give you a mental picture of what was going on was some nice, pretty one-line rhyme
mm-hmm.
by Alexander Pope. He went in the ocean, he fell down, and his knees were hurting. and basically, what he had done was he took from the Royal Society, they had a book. If you talk about running water, you say it's a torrent. If you say it's the sea, you say it's the briny. Just these directly taking words from instead of using the sea, you use this word. Instead of using this word, you use this word. And making one sentence out of, and it's totally incoherent, babbling, from something that, you know, you could actually have a real idea developed in your mind. It poses a paradox. Not a paradox so much as it brings a metaphor to you of someone who's drowned, yet they survive, as opposed to, you know, a one-line couplet that says, you know, he was weak in the briny and he fell down. Okay. It yeah. totally changes
yeah.
the whole...
Well, that was the purpose, because to deliberately keep metaphor out. You were not allowed to use it.
This came up last night. With their idea of language, I mean, because I was sitting there and I said to Ted, it's okay, I need to talk to you, Ted. Ted goes, look, what about? Yeah. And I show him, Ode to the West Wind. And he goes, that's like, and I said, he goes, that's like trying to start off with the Ninth Symphony. You know, I'm saying, you want to, you know, recite this. And he goes, so which one should I do? And then he recited, On Reflection.
I'm first hearing Chapman.
And so then I go okay. And then he leaves, and then I go and I read this poem. I'm like, okay, what is he talking about in here? And then you get to see this Pope. Okay, this Pope saying. And then you get it was a discovery of going from some imperfect, incoherent babbling of Alexander Pope, who was a contemporary of him around his time, and then going back to the 1611 translation. Done in poetic English by Chapman, and that was his great discovery because he had been reading that crap before, and now mm-hmm. he's like, so that's what it was. And that's what he's bringing out the discovery of something it's become more perfect now
yeah.
than what it was before. So we can do the same thing with English yet again.
Yes,
and it becomes more perfect. And we actually work on it.
Yeah.
Quick question, I'll be done with my questions. Could you give us a short outline of the different dialogues grouped in the best way that you guys have been able to come up with?
Well, not necessarily the best way we've come up with them, but I was just rethinking this from the standpoint of certain characteristics of the dialogues, because it seems to me they sort of fall into a couple of categories. You have the dialogues where the principal character in the dialogue is a very problematic philosopher or political figure. So you've got the dialogue, you've got Protagoras, you've got Gorgias. These are about some of the leading sophists of the time who had a very bad influence on society. I would put Alcibiades in a certain sense in that, because Alcibiades was a crucial political figure, although Alcibiades is somebody that Socrates had hopes for, that he could actually educate to be a philosopher king. And Alcibiades is a fascinating, tragic figure, if you actually read what happens to him. Because he's not only a tragic figure for failing to be educated and want to be educated by Socrates, he also ends up being a tragic figure in the sense that he's sort of like a reflection of society, and he gets exiled twice, he gets set up. I mean, he makes mistakes, they make mistakes, he tries to redeem himself at one point and come back to Athens and save him, he wins a battle, he gets exiled again, you know, because the political tides have changed. He's a fascinating figure, and The two little Alcibiades dialogues, while they may not be Plato, it's one of these where the authorship is in doubt. I mean, we frankly don't care all that much, because even if they're not Plato, it's somebody using the Platonic method, which is just as exciting. But those are two very poignant dialogues because of the political importance of Alcibiades. No, well, he's in the symposium too, but there's two little dialogues called Alcibiades I and Alcibiades II. And sometimes with a brand new group of people who've had no exposure to anything, I start with Alcibiades I, because it's a fairly simple methodological dialogue, and it helps set the historical setting as well.
No, yeah. David Chavin mentioned it, and
yeah.
I said, what are you talking about? There's a dialogue called...
It's in the very last lobe of volume, you know, with sort of the little pieces of things, which it's. I think it's in the same volume as the letters. Then you have, obviously, his geometrical, mathematical, cosmological dialogues, the Theaetetus, the Timaeus, the Meno. And then you have his dialogues on statecraft, which is the Republic and the laws. And then you do have that really fun series, which is, I think, the Protagoras actually starts that series, doesn't it? The Protagoras, the Statesman, and the Sophist? Is that how that works? There's three that follow on each other.
The Theaetetus
is the
Theaetetus,
first of that? Okay.
The Sophist, Statesman.
Okay, so, all right, so it's the Theaetetus, the Sophist, and the Statesman. Those carry over some of the characters from one to another, and they allegedly take place one after another in terms of the time they take place. And then you have some of the other dialogues, like the Lachis, and some of the smaller, not that popular ones. And they also include some very important figures. This figure Nicias, who's in the Lachis, is a crucial figure. In fact, he's essentially a semi-opponent of Alcibiades in terms of the decisions that are being made. I mean, I don't know. I can't make a final judgment on him, but he's actually the person who negotiated the Peace of Nicias, which would have stopped the Peloponnesian War in 421. So it would have ended after 12 years instead of after 30 years. But then he also ends up getting caught up in this ill-fated Sicilian expedition along with Alcibiades. So he's a key figure, and his inability, his axiomatic failures are in some sense, I think, the subject of the Lachis dialogue. So, I mean, the whole thing is just interwoven with the actual history of the period.
Can I ask a question?
You betcha.
I was studying, I was looking in the Republic. I was looking around and I ran into this guy named Theon of
Smyrna.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who is this guy?
That's why we have this book here.
He wrote a book called Mathematics Useful for Understanding Plato.
which is the book that I was talking about before, when we were reading Plato before we started this Plato section.
Mm-hmm.
And who is he? And is he?
Yeah, this looks.
I should or should not get this.
Yeah, well, I think it would definitely be worth looking at it. Here's what this guy says. A mathematician and Platonist who wrote a lost commentary on the Republic of Plato and an extant, existing, elementary work on arithmetic entitled Aspects of Mathematics Useful for Reading Plato,
mm-hmm.
which includes material on musical harmony and astronomy.
Yeah.
A work of his on the order in which to study Plato's works has recently been discovered in an Arabic translation.
Yeah, who's saying on the
top? Yeah.
So I found the book.
Uh-huh.
We need $50. And it's been translated. It was 1892.
Really?
From the Greek. It was a Greek-French translation into English. And it's translated by this guy named Robert Lawler. And he's done some other books that we actually have.
Mm-hmm.
And he translates stuff and he goes to
mm-hmm.
the mathematics. And stuff.
Hmm.
He wrote a book called Sacred Geometry. So I was wondering.
Oh, yeah. He wrote a book like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was wondering, this guy seems to have somewhat of an insight, somewhat esoteric sometimes, on some other things.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just wondering, do you know anything other than.
Other than that, no, but it sounds like fun.
Dan, where did you find out about him?
I found out about him when I was doing all the geometry and the Sacred Geometry book that I have at that moment right now.
What he
talked about is a specific quote where he was talking about the idea of intelligible reason. He was talking about archetypal, original ideas, and echotypal ideas, or intelligible reason, understanding, belief, faith. And he was taking this directly from
The Republic.
The Republic.
Yeah.
And I was reading The Republic by myself, trying to figure all this stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
This is right when the Strassica was going on. And
mm-hmm.
we're doing the Gauss and the Riemann. And I was looking at, because this is what he says. This still gets me. Geometry, arithmetic together with astronomy and music. The science of temporal order, that's music, through the observations of cyclical movement constituted the major intellectual discipline of classical education. And you had to be able to know this for leaders. And that's
yeah.
So I'm reading this and, okay, I want to understand this better. So then I run across this guy doing all
mm-hmm.
my research and then doing construction of all stuff
mm-hmm.
instead of just talking about it, construction. I run into this guy, Sion and Smyrna, and I was wondering.
It sounds like it's definitely worth working through. I mean, there's.
Okay,
the closer you get to Plato in terms of commentaries or, you know, elaborations, the better off you're going to be. I mean, doesn't mean they're all going to be on our side, or it doesn't mean they're going to all have it right or whatever, but the closer you get, the more you can begin to work through the dialogue of ideas that was happening at the time. And sometimes something which makes no sense to you in a section of Plato could have been one of the most important philosophical or geometrical, you know, debates going on at the particular time, and that's why Plato or Socrates is addressing it in a particular form.
Yeah, because a lot of times when we're reading the things, we've been reading for a while, at least I've been reading for a while since I first came around before I joined the Institute to see Timaeus, and it was Republic, then it was Timaeus. But the thing was, this is important, because this is the stuff that when we're reading it, we often, like today, we just kind of gloss over real quickly and you go past it. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Because he brought up, this is the thing that also gets me very excited, but this is, he brought up today in the
Euthyphro.
In the Euthyphro, he brought up an isosceles. You don't think this way anymore. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
An isosceles triangle and a scalene triangle as in the idea of even and odd numbers. And we figured out what an isosceles and a scalene triangle, but we still didn't quite answer the question of why was he thinking of even numbers as isosceles triangles and odd numbers as scalene triangles. And I think that goes back to the mathematics, which goes back to Pythagoras.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can actually... Then you can see why. What fundamental idea is he getting at when he says that? Because he's actually inserting something in
right.
a certain reason as a lever to change it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And it's kind of something that we kind of just wishy-wash over sometimes. And then Lynn talked about it, where we kind of wishy-wash over that, too.
Do you have any ideas on that?
Yeah.
Is it two and three? Separating the groups and numbers?
I'm sure it's Pythagorean. I mean, I've got, you know, just sort of an immediate impression of it, because an isosceles triangle has got two sides that are the same and one that's different, and a scalene is going to have three different sides. So, I mean, but that seems sort of simple-minded. I mean, it's just sort of a first blush. But if you stop and you just go back to a kind of Gaussian conception, you know, the Pythagoreans talk about numbers not from the standpoint of counting numbers, but they talk about numbers from the standpoint of geometry. You know, so they're always talking about triangular numbers, for example. You know, and you begin to discover different things. I mean, that's a triangular, 3 is a triangular number. You know, 6 is a triangular number. 10 is a triangular number. And this is considered, the question of the geometrical relationship among numbers, you know, numbers as representations of, as shadows of actual processes in the real world, is how the Pythagoreans look at numbers. They don't look at them as discrete counting numbers. So this what's it called? The sacred something, a word based on 10. I can't remember. But anyway, the Pythagoreans, you know, and then you look at different kind of relations of numbers from the standpoint of, I'm trying to think of some of the things I know the Pythagoreans do. I can't remember all of them. I can't remember any particular example beyond that. But for example, like one thing that finally threw some light on how to look at Egyptian mythology for me. The Egyptians, there's all sorts of different versions of collections of gods, you know, because you have different parts of Egypt, different parts of gods. But one of the older collections of gods in Egypt is the Aeneid, the 9. There are 9 key gods, and sometimes the membership of the 9 changes. You know, and they kept talking about the Aeneid, which is 9, and you know, I just kept sort of, all right, this is some combination which adds up to 9 somehow. And then I read one book which pointed out that 9 is, if you take that out of there, and essentially the idea of the 1, let's put the 1 back in there, the 1 is the 1, the overarching 1, and then the 9 gods around it are sort of the unfolding of the overarching 1, which is in the middle. So this question of looking at numbers not as a series of discrete counting numbers, but what is their geometrical relation, you know, to them. I mean, one, you know, if you haven't done this, this is fun. You know, also then just look at numbers. This is something Larry Hecht did, but I did it a while ago too. Just look at numbers from this, you know, from that standpoint, and just carry the thing through. So, you know, there's 1, 2.
On the whiteboard?
Huh? Yeah. I'm doing boxes, like 1 box, then 2 boxes next to it, then 3 boxes next to it, but then what do you get to? You get to the first square. But then you can't do that with 5. You know, so you just play with, you know, the geometrical relationship of these numbers as opposed to a series of discrete objects. That is in a very simple, you know, first approximation is the way the Pythagoreans and others looked at it, and I bet this guy gives you some good insight into that. The other commentary on Plato is Proclus, who's got a commentary on the Parmenides, a couple of books of the Republic, and the Timaeus. It's not even complete. The Timaeus doesn't even get into the really heavy stuff. But he's a, quote, Neoplatonist from the 2nd century or the 3rd century. But he just gives you more insight into how to approach it. You don't want to take any of them at face value, but you just sort of think, you realize they're speaking in a different language than than any 20th century discussion of Plato would be. Theon of Smyrna.
Right, I got that.
Theon. Yeah, Theon. Did someone say something?
Oh,
Yeah? But I'll tell you, when you're reading Plato and you get to these sections, please stop and work them through. I was just saying, when you get to these sections in Plato, stop. Somebody put the brakes on at that point.
Usually we just wax on a little bit, unless you have someone like Ted, who then at the end goes, the problem is we read the things and then people get all upset. Plato said that we should have censorship. What do you mean? And then Ted will bring it back. He goes, hold on, everybody. And listen really close. And he goes, the point was, do you want the children who are going to grow up to be the guardians of the city to be watching pornography? And then they're like, no. Well, that was the point. And then he goes to mathematical ideas. It gets a little bit more difficult to say. Not everybody even understands that. So
yeah, well, that's, I mean, when we did the Timaeus the second time, I mean, we just took the sections where he develops the different proportions and the different constructions, and we probably spent 2 months. I mean, we just sat there and played with the constructions and the proportions. We weren't interested in finishing the Timaeus. We were interested in figuring out what he was talking about. I mean, I think it took us a half a year to read the Timaeus the second time we did it. We were cutting and folding and constructing and discovering different ways that you could create an isosceles triangle by folding, which isn't necessarily in there, but we just stopped and, you know, actually played with the concepts. All right.
Thank you very much.
You bet.